That means Russia says Ukraine has unleashed its biggest shelling yet of the city of Donetsk. Israeli forces cut off water supply to more than 1,000 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. And also an Irish peacekeeper is killed in an attack targeting UN forces in London. Hello and welcome, everybody. Russia says eastern city of Donetsk has come under the most intense shelling by Ukrainian forces. The Russian-installed mayor of the city says 40 rockets from Grad multiple rocket launchers have been fired at the city. According to the official, this is the biggest shelling targeting Donetsk since the hostilities broke out 8 years ago. No casualties have been reported so far. There's been no immediate response to the mayor's comments from the Ukrainian side. Meantime, Russia has ruled out the possibility of a Christmas ceasefire as the fierce fighting continues for control of the eastern city of Bakhmut. Iran and Russia have enhanced their mutual cooperation over the past years in defiance of Western sanctions, apparently worrying the West. In recent years, relations between the two countries have been developing in all areas from trade to military deals. The outgoing year has particularly seen the strengthening of mutual cooperation in a number of strategic areas. Iran's ambassador to Russia elaborated on that at a press conference in Moscow.
While the West is expanding sanctions against Moscow and Tehran over their military cooperation, the potential for developing relations between the two countries is huge, since Russia and Iran are under tough Western sanctions and therefore have little to fear.
The will of our governments is interconnected. Our high-ranking officials and our peoples do not pay attention to the shouts of the entire West and continue to strengthen their ties and interaction.
At the press conference held in Moscow, Iran's ambassador to Russia summed up the outcome of relations between Moscow and Iran in 2022. He noted that Russia's ruble is used in more than 40% of trade between the two countries and that the Russian currency may become the main one in bilateral trade. According to his remarks, Tehran supported the idea of using the ruble as the main currency in regional unions such as the EAEU. He also referred to efforts to integrate the national payment systems MIR and Shetab as part of financial and economic cooperation between Russia and Iran. According to the Iranian envoy, Russia and Iran are seeking to reduce the dominance of certain currencies, including the dollar, in bilateral trade and economic relations. Jalali further said the automotive industry and space sector have become another field of cooperation between the two countries. In August, Russia launched remote sensing satellite Hayam into orbit on behalf of Iran.
As for our negotiations, I want to say that negotiations between our respective organizations in the field of outer space are ongoing on a regular basis.
Iran is investigating the possibility of producing cars jointly with Russia. Two leading automakers of the Islamic Republic, Saipa and Iran Hadro, took part in last summer's exhibition in Moscow and held negotiations with the Russian side. In addition to the joint production, the two countries are also discussing the possibility of sending Iranian cars to Russia. Russian and Iranian officials have time and again said that the two countries are determined to further expand bilateral cooperation. They have expressed confidence that the aim will materialize despite all the challenges the two nations might face, given the numerous capacities the two sides have. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
On this segment of the program, Russia is warning that all Western weapons supplied to Ukraine will be legitimate targets for its military. Foreign Ministry spokesman Maria Zakharova says all sorts of weapons supplied to Kiev by the West would either be destroyed or seized by Russia. Also, on Wednesday, the Kremlin issued a warning in reaction to media reports quoting unnamed American officials that a plan is being finalized to send Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. Based on the reports, the decision could be announced as soon as this week. The U.S. has recently boosted its air defense support for Ukraine, citing a surge in Russian missile attacks. Washington has provided Ukraine with over $19 billion in military assistance since the beginning of the war. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, who's joining us from Belgrade. Also, from Indre, Norway, we have author and commentator John Stepping. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. It's great to have both of you with us here on News Review. Mr. Bosnich, President Zelensky has for months been asking for Western weapons that could boost Ukraine's air defenses, but the U.S. has been reluctant to supply the Patriot system. Why the change of heart now? Do you see this as probably a turning point in this war? Okay, I believe we're experiencing some technical difficulties. While my colleagues sort that out, I'm going to address the same question to Mr. Stepling. We've seen a reluctance of Western countries, the United States specifically, in supplying the Patriot missile system to Ukraine. Why the change of heart now?
You know, it's funny because I was on here yesterday discussing the sanctions against Iran for selling weapons to Russia. And here we lead with a story about increased sales to Ukraine of more advanced U.S. Defense systems, missile systems, and guidance systems. This is not a particular game changer in any way. Patriot systems are useful. They are also easily identified. This is not going to change the nature of this conflict in any real way. Ukraine is already using American GPS and satellite tracking and so forth, just like the Saudis use American GPS and various guidance systems in their war against Yemen. So you know, it's another step, another sort of boiling the frog. You know, it's another degree turning up the heat. And presumably at some point there is a line in the sand for Russia, though this will certainly not be it. But it speaks to a number of things. The American general in his, you know, press conference said that it would take weeks, and what he meant was months, to teach Ukrainian soldiers and staff how to use the Patriot system. It's appreciably different system than the one they have right now. The Ukrainian forces are running out of officers. They're running out of experienced soldiers. They're running out of people. Period. The shelling of Donetsk increased last night acutely. I mean, it was the heaviest shelling of the Donbass region since 2014. That's what the reports I heard. So it was a massive uptick. There is a sense of desperation settling over Kiev. Zelensky is ever more strident in his pleading for money and weapons. And the U.S. media, the talking heads, are ever less sober and realistic, and they are more kind of hysterical and fantasist about the entire thing. And I'm home with my child here, so I'm trying to keep him out of the frame. But anyway, this is a news story without that much import, really. I mean, it's something that speaks to the U.S., you know, insistence on keeping the war going and avoiding peace negotiations. They keep stoking the aggression in one way or another, but this is not a military game changer. That's the point, I guess.
All right, let's bring the same question to Mr. Bosnich. We were talking about the capabilities of this system. Some experts believe that the Patriot's effectiveness is limited. In your opinion, will this system be a game changer in the war?
Well, as I was mentioning before, we had a little bit of a connection breakdown. First of all, we're not sure if the Patriot system is up to the current Russian technologies for counteracting such missiles. And secondly, we know absolutely that the Patriot system requires either American or Israeli operators. There is no chance whatsoever that the Ukrainian troops on the ground can operate the Patriot system. So putting the Patriot system on the ground in Ukraine means putting U.S. soldiers on the ground in Ukraine. And if you put U.S. soldiers on the ground in Ukraine at the command of Zelensky, he could purposely put them in harm's way to provoke a conflict directly between Russia and the United States. And I think that's the main threat here. The main threat here is that once Russia identifies the location of these batteries, and they are very, very easy to locate from the sky, then those batteries will be eliminated. Americans will be dead on the ground. Body bags will be coming back to America. And Zelensky will be smiling, because that's the only way, it seems, he can drag America into this war.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade. Author and commentator John Stepling, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. That brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. British nurses begin their strike in their first ever national walkout amid a bitter dispute with the government over pay. An estimated 100,000 nurses are walking off the job at nearly 80 hospitals and health centers. The walkout will cancel thousands of non-urgent operations and tens of thousands of outpatient appointments. It also is scheduled to take place next Tuesday. The strike has no precedent in the British Nursing Union's 106-year history. Nurses want a 19% pay rise, arguing they have suffered a decade of real-term cuts. On Wednesday, the Prime Minister and the opposition party leader had a heated debate on the issue.
Mr. Speaker, nurses going on strike is a badge of shame for this government. Instead of showing leadership, he's playing games with people's health.
Prime Minister!
It's right. If he thinks it's right that pay demands of 19% are met, then he should say so. What's weak, Mr. Speaker, is he's not strong enough to stand up to the union.
The government has so far refused to discuss pay, saying that it cannot afford to pay more than the 4 to 5% offered to nurses. Britain is facing a wave of industrial actions this winter, with strikes crippling the rail network and postal services, while airports are bracing for disruptions over Christmas. We're receiving reports that the Israeli regime has cut off water supply to more than 1,000 Palestinian residents in the West Bank as part of its continued pressure tactics. The community is one of the largest nomadic groups residing in Palestine. Let's now cross over to Ramallah, where our correspondent Mona Candil is standing by to shed more light on the Israeli regime's latest inhumane act against the Palestinian population. Mona, it's great to have you with us. What details do you have to share with us?
Well, as you have said, Al-Auja town, it's or Al-Auja community, north Al-Ariha, also known as Jericho, is one of the largest Bedouin communities in the Jordan Valley and in Ariha area. Israeli forces raided Al-Auja, a town, and they destroyed the main water pipeline of Al-Auja community. The Israeli forces welded shut the sole pipeline supplying water to some 1,200 residents of Al-Auja town in the area. And they also used bulldozer to erect earth mount to cover the pipeline. As you have said, it's the largest community, one of the largest communities of the Bedouin community in the Jordan Valley. The main aim of such acts, why the Israeli forces do so, it's as usual. The Israeli forces want to push Palestinians in these areas out of their communities in order to displace the residents and to seize first water and land to make room for the colonial settlement construction. At the one hand, they try in every possible mean to force Palestinians there out of their communities, and on the other hand, they give a green light for the settlers to expand their settlement and to build the new settler units in that area. Israel has restricted access to water in the area, especially to water springs. We are speaking about numerous water springs in that area, but under unjustified reasons, people are not allowed to have access to the water springs and use water there. The Israelis claim that sometimes the area should be used as, let's say, a military zone, or it's because very close to the illegal settlements. At the end of the day, Palestinians in the Jordan Valley, in Ariha, and in areas very close to the illegal settlements, they strive to access water.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona Candio, joining us from Ramallah. Well, there's been an armed attack on UNIFIL forces in Lebanon. An Irish peacekeeper has been killed and three others injured. For more on that story, we're now going live to the Lebanese capital, Beirut, to hear the latest from our correspondent, Mariam Saleh. Mariam, please bring us up to speed on this recent incident.
Well, obviously, there has been some complications when it has to do with this issue and the issues related to the UNIFIL mandate in Lebanon. Now, what we do know is that there was some sort of a problem with the people, with the residents of the area and the residents of a specific village, Al-Aqbiye, who had an issue with the UNIFIL forces, and that led to some sort of a squabble. And then there was armed fire. Of course, there will be an investigation. It's not clear who fired at the UNIFIL troops. However, when we speak to the witnesses there and those people who were there, they tell us that the UNIFIL forces were in an area, they had taken a road that they usually don't take, and that is not a part of their employment and their job and their mandate. Their mandate stipulates that they should not be in any sort of or conducting any sort of patrols in the area north of the Litani River. And that is where they were. They were in a tight road in a specific village in an area that is north of the Litani River. And that led many of the residents of the area to suspect why those forces have taken that road specifically. And that led to crowding, and many crowds of the residents of the area crowded around, surrounding them, trying to get information. And I'm saying once more that this is what some witnesses have said. And that led to some sort of a dispute with those forces, who actually drove into a shop as a result of the fact that they want to flee the area. They drove into a shop and nearly crashed people. And then they heard gunfire. So it is not clear exactly what happened. Now, just to give you more information on the significance of the mandate, of the UNIFIL mandate, which began in 1978. It has changed, of course, significantly throughout the years. And just recently, it has also been amended that the UNIFIL can actually act independently. And that is something that led to a lot of opposition from the Lebanese government and from many of the factions in Lebanon. And even the UNIFIL commander himself stressed that, no, the UNIFIL forces will continue to cooperate and coordinate with the Lebanese army. And that is what they usually do.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mariam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hidden Files.
Are you old enough to remember the emotional story about Iraqi soldiers stealing babies from incubators in a Kuwaiti hospital back in 1991? A Kuwaiti teenager introduced as Nayira said she had seen Iraqi soldiers take 312 infants out of their incubators and put them on the cold floor to die. Well, this story made headlines around the world and was repeated by political leaders, especially by U.S. President George H.W. Bush, who wanted to go to war against Iraq. Or perhaps you may remember the weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, that Iraq allegedly had. In February 2003, then U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, addressing the United Nations, claimed that Saddam Hussein was producing weapons of mass destruction. What we are giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence, Powell told the Security Council. And his address helped to win over the U.N. to wage war on Iraq in 2003. There's just one major problem with each of these stories, and that neither was true. But nevertheless, being false didn't stop these claims from causing havoc and destroying the lives of millions of people. Well, these are examples of what some may call an art, the art of propaganda. On this program, we will look at how propaganda was fine-tuned during World War I and why that matters to us today. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Over 100 years ago, in 1914, World War I broke out in Europe. Now, the Americans had declared neutrality, which was supported by both the president and the people. Edward Bernays was a nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he used his uncle's expertise in psychology with his own journalism background to create a way to make the unlikable more appealing. For example, when the American political elite had a change of heart and decided that the United States had to enter the war, they needed to figure out a way to convince a reluctant public of the need to get involved in that European war. Thus, the Committee on Public Information was formed, and its job was to change public opinion via mass persuasion. It was led by George Creel, and Bernays was a part of the group. There was a massive campaign of speeches, films, posters, etc., and it was extremely successful. CPI became the largest propaganda machine the world had ever seen up to that point. and its selling point was targeting the emotions of Americans without consideration of logic or even truth.
It was a plain publicity proposition, Creel recalled, a vast enterprise in salesmanship.
Creel was a pioneer, you might say, in the field of public relations. And then Wilson appoints him the head of something called the Committee on Public Information, which, not to put too fine a point on it, is essentially the U.S. government's agency for propaganda.
Creel saw his problem as transforming the American people into one white-hot mass of enthusiasm for the war. And the CPI went from a bureaucracy of one person to an army of about 100,000 people in the space of a couple of months.
The CPI mobilized movie stars for the Liberty Loan message. Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, all of the greatest stars of their day. Celebrity culture is just starting to emerge, and they can turn out crowds, and those crowds then become some of the biggest rallies that you see on the home front during the war.
Creel even found a way to push his message when the movie screens were dark.
In between every reel of film, there was a four-minute break when the projectionist had to change the reels. Someone at the CPI hit on the idea that this was a perfectly captive audience for the delivery of the war message.
Prominent members of the local community would stand up and deliver short patriotic speeches. They became known as the Four-Minute Men. And what began in movie theaters quickly spread to any venue where an audience assembled. In New York, Creel's volunteer army addressed 500,000 people each week. 10 men gave talks in Yiddish, 7 in Italian. President Wilson himself gave a 4-minute speech.
These 4-minute men would give a talk on some aspect of Americanism, why we are fighting, what are the principles we're fighting for.
The appearance of spontaneity masked a carefully scripted government message. These were no haphazard talks by nondescripts, Creel insisted, but the careful, studied, and rehearsed efforts of the best men in each community. Each speech aimed as a rifle is aimed, and driving to its mark with the precision of a bullet.
They were guided by a central authority, but always in the own words of the individual giving the speech, and he was usually a person who was known in the community. He was not saying, this is what the government says. He was saying, I'm an intelligent person, successful person, this is what I think, you should think this way too.
So propaganda, or as it became known as, public relations, was such a success during that war that afterwards it became a permanent fixture of American society and other places to sell anything from products that people may not need or not have the money for to wars that people had no interest in being a part of. Well, that was the roots of modern propaganda, but it has been fine-tuned with great sophistication and effect, and has led to the current world of television and modern media. Much has been invested in trying to direct the human psyche, and nothing has been more effective than mass media, where it can demonize those seen as the enemy or immortalize those seen as friends. Well, to help me take a closer look at all of this, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program.
Dr. Tim Anderson is director of the Sydney-based Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. He worked as a lecturer and senior lecturer at Australian universities for more than 30 years, teaching, researching, and publishing on human rights in development, customary land in Melanesia, small farming and food security, health systems and infectious disease, Cuban medical internationalism, self-determination in development, independent regional integration, and resistance to the wars of the 21st century. His most recent books are Land and Livelihoods in Papua New Guinea, 2015, The Dirty War on Syria, 2016, now published in 10 languages, Countering War on Propaganda of the Dirty War on Syria, 2017, Axis of Resistance Towards an Independent Middle East, 2019, and The Pandemic and the Independent Countries, 2020.
Welcome to the program, Tim. I want to look at the concept of propaganda. I mean, the way it was used in the past, and also if we look at how it's used today.
We're looking at virtually a century of propaganda used in society generally, but in particular in relation to war, as you mentioned, the First World War and where Bernays' ideas were developed, I suppose. And there was a great effort to try and persuade the US public back then, 100 years ago, to get involved in what was essentially a European war between a reconfiguration of power between the old empires. And that had a role also in empowering the U.S. voice, and the US, including the U.S. Zionist voice in British politics of the time, which, of course, became important because the British and the French were the colonial powers that took over the old Ottoman Empire and started to carve up the Levant and particularly, of course, Palestine. And, you know, the Balfour Declaration was part of that. So the role of the U.S. Zionists in that propaganda a century ago is an important one to remember. Now, if we look at the type of propaganda today, I believe it's far more sophisticated. I think that they are dealing with more highly educated populations. The systematic character of the propaganda and the messages, as Bernays said, emotional messages, more important than the actual facts. You know, for example, we look at a particular incident becomes much less important than the overall messaging that's going on around that particular incident. And that's very important today, I believe, in hybrid wars that are largely led by the liberal side of US imperialism, which likes to have proxy wars. It likes to have propaganda wars, economic wars, and so-called smart power, which is about getting other people to fight their wars and other people to finance their wars.
I mean, propaganda may not be based on truth. I want to look at how dangerous that is for us, especially today.
I said populations are more educated these days, not necessarily that they're more intelligent, but in some ways, very simple people with strong values sometimes understand these issues better than more highly educated populations. That's the sad reality. And those of us in Western cultures or English-speaking cultures, let's say, have to deal with as a huge challenge. Why is it that people swallow the weapons of mass destruction, lies, the Gaddafi feeding Viagra to his troops? They're using that same lie against the Russians at the moment. There are so many recycled fictions that are used to disarm a population and to get rid of the opposition to the latest war, the latest proxy war, for example, that it depends on techniques that are quite constant. And of course, one part of it is the domination of the media, the control of the social media to a large extent, the insistence, the repeated nature of these lies, like, you know, the chemical weapons in Syria, repeated for year after year after year until it comes to a point where people can't imagine that there wasn't some truth to this particular lie. But you've also got, I believe, on the part of Western audiences, a predisposition to want to believe that they are helping in some way, or they are on some human rights crusade when they back the latest economic war or military intervention against the country. It's an extraordinary thing, and I think it bothers me as an educator in a Western society that we have to really start studying the nature of stupidity in Western populations, because it's not all about information. It's also about people's emotional predisposition to believe these sorts of fictions about the character of war after war after war. I mean, thinking people have to raise some questions, but nevertheless, the propaganda machine depends upon the fact that there are all these reinforcing messages and those questions don't really reach a very high level.
Well, another part of propaganda is demonizing the other and controlling information. For example, on certain platforms right now, we see how Press TV or RT are labeled as state-controlled media. But when it comes to VOA or BBC that are government-funded, that is not the case. So already from the beginning, when someone looks at these alternative pages or networks, they'll be met with negative feelings or perspective. I mean, your take on all of this?
They put those tags in an extremely partisan way. Voice of America, of course, is completely funded by the US government, but same with the BBC. But they claim there's some difference between the BBC and Press TV, for example, in character. Of course, there isn't. I mean, there's other important mechanisms which you will find fairly readily through experimentation. The search engines, for example, if you search human rights and Iran, for example, you're going to find a huge number of sources from the US and from Britain and from their embedded NGOs, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International and so on. But if it's Iran talking about human rights, you'll have to look very carefully to find that those references. The same with China. If you want to find China's report on human rights in the US and you search China, human rights US, you will find everything about the US saying human rights in China, and you'll look very hard to try and find what China is saying about human rights in the US. So there are a number of mechanisms there that are at play to deliberately curtail the flow of information, to prevent people from accessing a range of information and channeling it down to repetition of the same sources.
So, I mean, when there are so many controls put in place, what is key in order to discern truth from fiction in this massive world of propaganda?
I find very encouraging the fact that there are good media collaborations between Latin America and West Asia. And one of the examples is Almayadeen, for example, which is largely in Spanish and Arabic and now beginning in English. And that's really a collaboration between independent West Asian media and independent Latin American media. Then you have Hispan TV, which is a collaboration with the same with independent Latin American media, Iranian media in Spanish. Then we have Telesur itself, which is a continental network in Latin America, which is still a very powerful and universal source of information in Latin America. So the Russians also have some collaborations, the Chinese to a more limited extent now, but at least we're seeing with the division of the world into big blocks that you can go to large media organizations in China, in India, for example, if you want to get some independent sources of information about what's happening in Ukraine, for example. But the domination of the Anglo-Americans of media sources is something that's been there for a long time, and it's developed a great capacity, and it's a huge advantage that the Anglo-Americans have in the world of propaganda.
Well, I appreciate your insight into all of this. Thanks so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. Well, remember I mentioned the Kuwaiti girl at the top of the show who talked about what she had witnessed?
Thank you very much. Our final witness is also using an assumed name, and again we ask our friends in the media to respect the need for her to protect her family. And we finally call on Naira to testify.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Naira, and I just came out of Kuwait. My mother and I were in Kuwait on August 2nd for a peaceful summer holiday. My older sister had a baby on July 29th, and we wanted to spend some time in Kuwait with her. I only pray that none of my 10th grade classmates had a summer vacation like I did. I may have wished sometime that I could be an adult, that I could grow up quickly. What I saw happen to the children of Kuwait and to my country has changed my life forever. It has changed the life of all Kuwaitis, young and old. We are children no more. My sister, with my 5-day-old nephew, traveled across the desert to safety. There was no milk available for the baby in Kuwait. They barely escaped when their car was stuck in the desert sand, and help came from Saudi Arabia. I stayed behind and wanted to do something for my country. The second week after invasion, I volunteered at the Al-Adan Hospital with 12 other women who wanted to help as well. I was the youngest volunteer. The other women were from 20 to 30 years old. While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor. It was horrifying.
Well, just remember, no matter how emotional that appeal was, everything she said was a lie. Nayira was actually the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. Her fake testimony played a role in the killing of 1.5 million Iraqis dying from starvation due to U.S. sanctions, and tens of thousands of Iraqis dying during the U.S. 1990s war Desert Storm. But no one ever held Nayira, nor did they hold the United States accountable for this falsehood. Millions of Iraqis lost lives and millions of disrupted lives were left behind. And a big part of it was all due to a lie. Propaganda can kill if packaged with the right covering. So be careful and stay aware. That brings us to the end of the show. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and I hope you will join myself and all the crew right here next week for Hidden Files.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, welcome to Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. One of the keys of life is for me and you to be clean. And we said it is a trademark of a Muslim, yet alone a mu'min. A mu'min takes it even more seriously. keeping himself clean, looking clean, and smelling nice and pleasant. When we look at the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, we see that they have spoke so much on the fact that me and you need to be constantly clean and looking nice. Al-Imam Ja'far Sadiq alayhi salamullah, he says, Ista'sil sha'rak, trim your hair, shave your hair. Why, ya Imam, we may ask. He says, yuqallilu darano. The dirt becomes a lot less because we do know the hair attracts dirt. Wadawabihi, and also hair attracts insects. For example, with hair itself, we have laces, we have other, you know, dandruff, we have other things that live on the scalp and that might create, you know, problem for a person. So the Imam says, if you cut and trim and have a haircut, it not only keeps it clean, but it keeps disease away from it. وَوَسَخِهِ, and the dirt as well. If you do so, he says, وَتَغْلُضُ رَقَبَتَكَ, your neck will become a lot thicker, which means healthier, if you keep trimming your hair and shaving your hair. وَيَجْلُو بَصَرَكَ, and your eyesight becomes a lot stronger. Now, I'm not a doctor, so I don't understand or I don't know the link between eyesight and the length of the hair. But because the Imam alayhi salam, he did say so, that the longer the hair is, the weaker the eyesight is. Now, this is a hadith for the medical practitioners and professionals to search. But obviously, when we trim and shave our heads, our eyesight becomes a lot stronger. So you can see that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, not only they ask us to be clean, but in fact, they tell us the reasons to why and what happens, especially when it comes to cutting our hair. Now, we have a lot of people these days, they keep their hair long, they hardly wash it. Sometimes it smells, sometimes it becomes oily, sometimes it becomes, you know, it attracts dandruff and dirt. It's not a nice sight for a believer, especially for the youth. And sometimes the youth, they say, well, the Ahlul Bayt had long hair, why can't we? Well, who said they did? And even if, alayhimu salam, they did, maybe because they did not have the facilities that we used to have today. Now, there is no istihbab. It is not a recommended act to keep your hair long. In fact, you see the Ahlul Bayt constantly telling us to cut our hair short. If they are instructing me and you to keep our hair short and cut, do you think they would keep theirs long? So they preach that which they do not do? I highly doubt it. Let us take a break. We continue right after.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فرون دماغ و ثواب داره فرون روزون
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فرون درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree.
محیط زیست نگه سالم نگه داره این دقیقه ثواب داره
There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدری گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون این هم همون امام گفته دیگه
When growing wheat take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Listeners, you are listening to the program Keys of Life, Mafatihul Hayat, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, he talks about the key of life of being clean, and he gives us 10 instructions. He says, خَمْسٌ مِنَ السُّنَنِ فِي الرَّأْسِ. There are 5 traditions in the head. وَخَمْسٌ فِي الْجَسَدِ. And there are 5 traditions in the body. So we have 10 traditions altogether. فَأَمَّا الَّتِي فِي الرَّأْسِ. As that which is in the head. What must we do with the head? First, he says, فَالسُّوَاك. Brushing your teeth. That's a tradition, a sunnah of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. 1. وَأَخْذُ الشَّارِبْ. For the men to trim their mustaches. وَفَرْقُ الشَّعْرِ. To comb your hair, to fix it. And that's just very straightforward. وَالْمَضْمَضَةُ. And to gargle water in your mouth. وَالْإِسْتِنْشَاقُ. To inhale water with your nose. So these are 5 things we need to do with our body. And you can see, mainly they rotate around the mouth area. Because we have to, you know, during our day, we face one another. So I have to make sure that my breath is not smelly, that it smells nice, it smells fresh. So I don't harm those whom I come in contact with. وَأَمَّا الَّتِي فِي الْجَسَدِ. As for that which is in the body, he says, فَالْخِتَان. A person needs to be circumcised, and that is a compulsory in jurisprudence in fiqh. وَحَلْقُ الْعَانَ. And for a person to shave his pubic area. وَنَثْفِ الْإِبْطِ. And to shave the armpit. وَتَقْلِيمُ الْأَظَافِرِ. And to cut one's nails. وَالْإِسْتِنْجَاءُ. And for a person that when he goes to the bathroom, he washes his areas, private parts, cleanly, which is also a wajib. Now you can see these 5 things when it comes to the body. They are also, the Imam concentrates on, areas that sometimes are neglected. When it comes to pubic area, for example, when it comes to the armpits, when it comes to the nails, people forget to do them. Or at least they get lazy to do them. The Ahl Bayt, they say, no, it needs to be constantly cleaned, be it when it comes to the private parts or the armpits, because you live with a spouse, be it male or female. You need to look nice and clean for your spouse. When it comes to people, for example, you need to make sure that you smell nice. And when it comes to nails, we said, because nails accumulate a lot of dirt, a lot of bacteria. And when it comes to making sure that your private parts are cleaned and, you know, the purification done correctly, because tahara is a compulsory act before any act of worship like salah, for example. So we have to constantly maintain the cleanness of our body and the cleanness of our head. So the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam, they did not leave anything unturned or anything unspoken of, especially when it comes to the cleanness of the human body. The hadith says, Allah is clean and He loves cleanness. And the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam says, cleanness is part of iman, and nadafatu min al-iman. If a person is dirty, then surely his iman is short. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents
a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.